Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The sound of the ceremony on Monday at the United States Capitol as members of the military, dignitaries, family members, and citizens welcomed the late President George Herbert Walker Bush to Washington for the final time. As the body of Bush 41 rests in the Capitol Rotunda, the late president is being remembered as a transitional leader, taking office as the Cold War ended in a whimper, not a bang, an achievement he is being credited with because of his behind-the-scenes work on healing the rifts of that conflict, work that was informed by a resume without equal in the annals of presidential history. World War II veteran, congressman, ambassador, director of the CIA, vice president, and as a president who hoped for us to be kinder and gentler. That is how he has been described by those who knew him. He's also been called one of the most underrated presidents of all time. This hour, we reflect on President George H.W. Bush's life and presidency and the lessons he left behind. And we are joined by Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. Welcome back.
Thank you.
She is in our studio and with us by phone, Gibbs Knotts, chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston. Thank you for rejoining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
If you would like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. As the two of you have been following and watching this ongoing coverage on television and listening to it on the radio about President Bush number 41, what characteristics of Mr. Bush have resonated the most with you? And I'll begin with you, Susan.
Well, I think few of us cannot look at his death in the context of what's going on now with Trump. And I think it's the era of civility, modesty, humility, a sense of government service, public service. You know, it's not realistic to think every public office or official has the sort of military service that he's had. But I think it's maybe not the end of an era, but it's a very, very much of a change in the image of the presidency. And not so much we've had leaders, but I think it's just his demeanor and, as you said, the resume he brought to the office and the era of civility. And the Bush family said, we don't want trashing Trump at this time. And I don't intend, and I don't think we need to trash Trump, but I think we have to make some parallels.
Yeah. Gibbs Knotts.
Yeah, I think Susan's exactly right. I mean, I don't expect Trump's name to be mentioned really at all. I didn't hear his name mentioned at the ceremony at the Rotunda at the Capitol, and certainly not mentioned at any of the funerals. But you know, the contrast are so clear. You know, Gibbs was the last World War II veteran to serve in the Oval Office, you know, and really just experience. I mean, an era where, you know, experience wasn't a bad thing. I mean, Bush came in with this completely, you know, impressive resume and was able to, you know, make the argument that to have an experienced president will move our nation forward. And that's, you know, that's not necessarily something that won out in 2016.
And yet he was a one-term president. So
that's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, his longtime friend and advisor, Jim Baker, I think has been on the shows a lot saying, look, mm-hmm. Perhaps going to go down as the best one-term president ever. I'm starting to rack my brain to think of the other one-term presidents. Obviously, Jimmy Carter was a one-term president. We don't have a ton of one-term presidents, but you know, he may very well be the best one-term president of all time.
Do you think that he was a one-term president because the American public gets antsy? And they had 8 years of Ronald Reagan and then 4 years of George H.W. Bush. And maybe they just wanted a change, had nothing to do with him. Or was it something he did or did not do?
Well, I think that he was criticized for not communicating well with the American public, even though everyone said he had a sense of empathy that was unparalleled. When you look at some of the public approval, he went in 1991 from 89% job approval to a year later, 29%. And that was the economic downturn.
Right.
And I think some people felt as if he didn't understand their pockets. And he could have been unfairly criticized because he came from a very not just patriarchal, but, you know, a privileged background. And I think that the people are looking at image. And also, too, you had the Perot factor that really disturbed the electoral results. So I think you're right that the people do get tired, but I think there were some things.
Yeah.
They have a very short life memory. Things don't have a long shelf life.
And you're referring to Ross Perot, who was
a
spoiler in that campaign,
yeah.
An independent candidate who got a lot of attention, media attention. Let's get back to this idea that perhaps he didn't understand the pain of the American public because of his background. He was... We often talk about American royalty and the Kennedys being American royalty, but the Bushes were the real the real royal family here. The Kennedys were wannabes. They wanted into the club. Joe Kennedy wanted to be like Prescott Bush. So let's talk about that for just a couple of seconds. How did he turn out to be the kind of person that he has been described as being, at least in interpersonal relationships, as being kind and gentle and considerate and concerned about people and rarely using the word I in speeches because his mother said, don't brag. How do you juxtapose that with him coming from this patrician, northeastern, royal, wealthy family, Gibbs?
Well, I think, Mike, you're right. I think his mother, it sounds like she played a really big role in that. You know, here's a guy who went to the best schools, but, you know, as he graduated from, you know, an exclusive high school, he said, you know, I want to sign up and join the Navy and be part of World War II. And, of course, got his wings and was shot down. And so, but somebody who, you know, was very humble, came back and went to college, but went to Yale, which, you know, obviously is a very elite institution, but also he was married while he was there. And so, you know, probably had a little bit of a different experience than some of the folks who were there. Actually had a kid. George W. Bush, I think, was alive when he was attending Yale. And so I do think probably his family and just that, you know, look, it's part of, I think, that greatest generation that, you know, was shaped by the Depression, although not to suggest that he necessarily suffered from the Depression because of the upbringing that you talked about. But I think that left a lasting impact on people from that generation. And he was able to, you know, just be very humble and very deferential and made people feel, you know, feel really important.
Susan.
Well, I think you can also look at his experience as being part of a team. And I think that's the weeness, whether it was when he played baseball or was in the Navy or when he went to get his fortune in Midland, Texas. I think also the death of his daughter. I think there were a lot of things that humbled him. And I think that working with a team, I just remember Trump saying, I alone can do it, and then that can also mean I can do it alone. That would never have been George Herbert Walker Burst.
And, of course, veterans of World War II came out of that war with a very specific worldview and a very specific point of view about themselves and their role in the world, and he was shot down. So, and I'm told, if you listen to all the coverage, that he thought about the two other guys in his airplane who did not survive almost every day of his life, and probably used them as touchstones going forward to make sure he used his life to the fullest. And he certainly did. I mean, even before that happened, wealth and privilege took him to Phillips Academy. He didn't have to enlist in the war.
Yeah.
He did, got out of the war after being shot down, went to Yale, as you mentioned, Gibbs. And it's not unusual, has not been unusual, for a lot of commanders in chief to have served in the war up until he was the end of it.
Yeah,
because
I think so.
When the baby boomers came in, most of them had never served. So what does that mean? What has the absence of military service in our commander-in-chiefs meant to the country as opposed to people like George H.W. Bush?
Well, I think it means that you lose that sense of what the country is about. I may add this, too. We may be entering another wave in which we see veterans in public office, because we had a number of women who were veterans that ran and won public office. And so it's not as if we have, not to be cynical, we have some wars that are going on and people can serve. But I think it is one of the things that gives you the sense of country. And that's been lacking in the past, and it's clearly lacking now.
Also gives you the sense, it would seem to me, of the realities of war. We are pretty much shielded from the realities of war. We don't see the carnage on television. We really don't. I mean, other television situations in other countries show you what's going on. We don't see it because we have to be protected from it, quote unquote, protected from it.
Right. We don't have a draft anymore.
Right.
And, you know, we have a sort of different person serving in the military, and it's, you know, a lot of folks that aren't from privilege and aren't from wealth that are doing, you know, and many minority Americans that are being sent over to fight in these far off places. And so it's a different situation than it was during World War II.
So let's talk about his politics, and we'll do that when we come back in a moment. We're here with Dr. Gibbs Knotts, chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston, and Dr. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are remembering President George H.W. Bush, whose service this morning will be at 11 o'clock, and we'll be carrying that live here on WFAE. We're here this morning with Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College and Dr. Gibbs Knotts, the chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston. We talked about how he was raised in privilege. We've talked about how he went to Yale. We've talked about how he fought in World War II. These are all things that people know pretty well by this point. But then he moved to Texas. He took his family to Texas to get into the oil business. Why? Where did that come from? What did Prescott Bush, his father, do? Do we know?
I mean, I'd always assumed he just, you know, wanted to be able to strike out on his own, to be able to show some success in business. I think he probably always thought about being involved in politics. I mean, he ran, you know, he didn't always win, you know, ran some races. He lost his first race, but I think probably just wanting to go out and make it on his own before getting involved in the political
system. Yeah, because he moved his whole family to Midland, Texas, I think it was, and sold drilling equipment, and later on went to start his own or buy his own oil drilling company. And he also ran for Senate in Texas. He lost. He ran for Congress, served two terms. He ran, of course, as a Republican. For those who don't remember what the Republican Party of that era was like, what did it mean to be a Republican when George Bush was in the Congress?
Well, I think, and in the when you look at the presidency and you look at post, you know, Ronald Reagan, where Bush was as the VP and then as the president, but I think it was not even fiscal conservative, social liberal. It was more of a time when, as they've said, there were dog whistles from the Republican Party. And it wasn't a very pretty time. There was a lot of contrast. But there was, in certain instances, there was bipartisanship, at least during George H.W. Bush.
Yeah. He became go ahead, Gibbs.
I was going to say, in the South, too, you know, keep in mind, it was hard to find Republicans. They were few and far between. And so one of the other things about George H.W. Bush was the role, you know, he played in seeing this region of the country, which had very few Republicans when he started getting involved in politics, to now being a region where Republicans are the dominant party. And so he got in early. He got in on the, just like he was trying to strike out in the oil business, you know, he got in early on the Republican transformation in the South. And Texas is now, as we just saw with the Senate race, still a pretty solidly Republican place.
Yeah. And the reason I asked the question about what it meant to be a Republican when George H.W. Bush was in Congress was not to disparage the Republican Party, because both parties have changed over time. They've switched positions on things. The Republicans have essentially become Democrats. Democrats have essentially become Republicans on certain things. At the time, what were the Democrats? What did it mean to be a Democrat? in that time?
Well, I think to be a Democrat was socially more liberal, but I think there was still an era of, you know, the Democrats wanted, as Bush got into the White House, nobody wanted those higher taxes, but the Democrats realized that that was part of the package. I have a lot of, not misgivings, but I wouldn't put money on turning Texas blue. And I think there are too many people that think that's the case. But I think that George Herbert W. Bush, and I may just say Bush today because we'll get
Bush 41.
Bush 41. I think he did. John Cornyn said, if you want to understand Bush, he's an American first, and second, he's a Texan.
Wow. He became the chairman of the Harris County, Texas Republican Party in 1963, and a year later ran against Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Ralph Yarborough. Now, I remembered the name, but I actually had to look up Ralph Yarborough because it was a long time ago. He was a progressive Democrat from Texas, which tells you where Texas was in those days. Candidate Bush attacked Yarborough as a left-wing demagogue and for his vote in favor of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Yarborough denounced Bush as an extremist to the right of that year's GOP nominee for president, Barry Goldwater. It's pretty hard to be to the right of Barry Goldwater.
Was he,
or is that just an epithet that was being thrown
around?
Well,
I think that's an exaggeration, but okay. I think he was into that tent of Goldwater. And I think if you look at what he had done in further races, that is one thing. I looked back, and Bush 41 did have some regrets, according to Jesse Jackson, about a few of the things he had said and done. And later, and we'll talk about this probably, Jackson said that Bush 41 said to him the Willie Horton ad was his biggest regret.
I'm going to talk about that, absolutely.
Yeah.
But he also was described by his opponent, Ralph Yarborough, as a carpetbagger and a rich Easterner. And Yarborough won that race. What was the turning point? Does anybody remember? Did he ever have a chance against an incumbent Democrat who was fairly popular?
It's just so hard for Republicans to break through. You know, Texans might have started to vote a little bit for, you know, Dwight Eisenhower and Republicans at the very top of the ticket. But for a Republican to get elected to the Senate, I mean, that was really strong Democratic territory. There were a few Democrats that spoke out on civil rights and race relations issues, Al Gore Sr., Estes Kefauver from Tennessee. But, you know, those individuals usually ran into electoral trouble because they would get challenged but either by other Democrats or by Republicans at being too soft on some of those types of issues. And so this was a Democratic Party that was, in the South at least, still very conservative, very supportive of segregationist policies. And it was just kind of crazy to think that they were also aligned with Democrats from other parts of the country that had more progressive ideas on race.
It gets a little thicker in Texas in that year, according to Wikipedia at least. It has since been learned that then Texas Governor John Connally, who most of us know because he was in the car with John Kennedy when Kennedy was shot, he was covertly aiding George Bush.
Interesting.
Instead of, if this is true, you have to take with Wikipedia with a grain of salt here. But instead of he was supporting Bush instead of Yarborough against President Johnson's wishes. If that is true, it was obviously because of the Civil Rights Act, of the passage of which lost the Democrats the entire South up to this point.
Well, they say it was still the solid South unless you started seeing Republicans be elected to the sheriff's office. But I think you also have to look at when Johnson came along, he said, and there are expletives that I will not repeat, he said, I want the blank-blank Voting Rights Act ever passed. And I think there was that consideration that a Texan needed to speak as someone that was progressive and not confused, if you will, with racial issues. But I don't want to mess with Texas. So I don't know. You know, I didn't go to Wikipedia. I didn't get the context.
So was George Bush, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, was he really against the Civil Rights Act? Or was that simply political posturing that needed to be done if he wanted to win?
Well,
Go ahead.
Well, I will say this. One historian, presidential historian, it wasn't Meacham, said that intellectually and emotionally, he was the kind of person that would not have trucked with something that was that racial. But in running in Texas, he had to make, in his own mind, some things that were publicly appeal to the less enlightened.
You want to comment on that, Gibbs?
Just that it would have been very hard to win statewide at that time period and be a progressive on the Civil Rights Act. I mean, you know, a few folks who
But Yarborough won. Yarborough won, and he was on board.
But he had established, I mean, he's an established person. He, you know, he had a lot of capital built up to come in as a new person and stake out a more progressive position on that, I think, would have been very, very hard at that time period.
So once George Bush finally got to Washington, certainly by the time he became president, he has been described as a rare figure, a man without enemies, or with very few, at the very least. People respected him, they liked him, but on the stump, particularly when he was up against the affable Bill Clinton, he seemed removed and privileged and out of touch. We've already kind of alluded to this, and he certainly appeared out of touch when the economic waters turned muddy during his presidency. How can someone so good on a one-on-one level with people of all stations in life, who writes notes to people who, like the butler and the maid and people like that, how can that person be so aloof or appear to be aloof or out of touch or distant on the stump when you're a politician?
Well, I think that's something that he acknowledged he didn't understand about himself. And communication skills were starting to get more and more important. And they weren't communication skills, we have to remember, that were tweets. They were going to the people. They were speeches. They were being in front of the public. But I think he was the kind of person, I think we looked sometimes, that couldn't bring that to a larger audience. And I think there are people all over, you know, even academia, that can't really get to, you know, the masses or to a larger audience. But I think that question, I don't know the exact answer, it confused him, because he thought he understood people, mm-hmm. and people thought he understood what was going on in the country, but he couldn't convey it. And that's, communication skills are now and were starting to be essential to the presidency.
And he seemed to be a man, everybody has an ego, and I don't think you can be the president of the United States if you don't have an ego, but he was somebody who could he could tamper it down, and did, and he had a sense of humor about things. The Dana Carvey impression of him is classic on Saturday Night Live,
right.
And he liked that impression, and I'm told they went on to be very good close friends over the years.
Yes, it wasn't just he was invited to the White House. They became good friends. And I think one thing about that they've talked about Bush 41 is that he took a couple of positions, chair of the RNC and also director of the CIA, that weren't potentially politically advantageous. So he did make some decisions that theoretically could not have served him well if you're pursuing electoral office. And he did have the ambition to become president, but I don't think it was raw, naked ambition.
Right. To take over the RNC right after Watergate, I mean, that had political balls written all over it, and he was able to, you know, keep the ship afloat and, you know, keep people on board and run for president just a few years later.
Yeah, he did that time and time again, and I want to talk about that a little bit later on in the program, because he took a series of jobs that were treacherous, to say the least, and improved the situation and survived the situation. His resume was, and we've talked about this, remarkable, some would say unparalleled, for anybody ever to hold the Oval Office, a combat pilot, a businessman, a congressman, emissary to China, ambassador to the UN, director of the CIA. He ran for president in the primary against the eventual winner, Ronald Reagan, criticizing Ronald Reagan's supplied side or trickle-down economic theory. He lost to Reagan, but Reagan then named him in a surprise move at the convention as his vice presidential running mate. Why, Gibbs, did Reagan do that?
So Reagan's a governor from California, and he had experience as a chief executive, but still was an anti-establishment candidate in a lot of ways. And so Bush gave him instant credibility. Bush understood Washington. Bush understood foreign affairs, having been ambassador to the United Nations. And so he really complimented Reagan. Plus, he represented a huge state in the South, an area where Republicans knew that if they wanted to, you know, to win, they would need to do very well.
And you contrast maybe his lack of communication style, Bush 41, yeah, with
the great communicator
yeah, Ronald Reagan. And I think he really did see Bush 41 as someone that was a leader. And, you know, Bush, his staff, they coined the term, if you die, we fly. So his staff and the VP, he didn't know his place. We don't want to say that, but it was Gore that really redefined the role of the VP.
He took on President Reagan, then candidate Reagan, and his, as I said, his supply side or trickle down economic theory, took it on, said it was voodoo economics. He had to backtrack on that when he became the vice president. Mm-hmm. Is that something history should take him to task for? Because he was right about it. Should history take him to task for that, or is that merely the day-to-day jostling of politics? And I have about 35 seconds. Gibbs.
I think it's the day-to-day jostling. And you know, I think, obviously, Reagan, you know, when you become vice president, you have to generally get on the team of the president. So I think that, you know, says as much about Bush and his willingness to work as a team and get on board with the policy as anything else.
You want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's true. And I guess the teamwork, he did say, Bush 41 said, 8 years as a VP was not the same thing as being president.
Right. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about him on the George H.W. Bush on the campaign trail and what kind of a campaigner he was, particularly as he went through South Carolina and changed his presidential fortunes. Dr. Susan Roberts is with us, along with Dr. Gibbs Knotts. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Your idea could be the next great podcast. WFAE has launched the Queen City PodQuest, a contest to find a new story for the next big show. All ideas are welcome. Submit yours by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City PodQuest.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about President George Herbert Walker Bush, who will have his service, his state funeral, I guess, this morning at the Washington National Cathedral at 11. We'll be carrying that live here on WFAE. Dr. Susan Roberts is in our studio, political scientist at Davidson College. Dr. Gibbs Knotts, chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston, joins us by phone. And he's just written, it's in the final editing stages, a book called First in the South. It's a book about the South Carolina Republican Party, how it got to be such an important primary and one that seems to have been able to predict the outcome, at least for Republicans in presidential races. And we'll talk about that when the book is published, I promise. But we're about to talk about the South Carolina primary, which we'll get to in a second. And I'm sure you'll have some things to say about that. Charles Pierce, who is a writer at large at Esquire, has taken Bush 41 to task for setting up the Republican Party in a way that made the Trump presidency inevitable. I don't know whether you'll agree with this or not, but he said that he could have beaten Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis in 1988 without having to resort to the tactics laid out by Lee Atwater, who said, in politics, the ends always justify the means. And he could have won without resorting to what you alluded to a few minutes ago, Susan Roberts, using Willie Horton, who was furloughed from prison in Massachusetts under Governor George Dukakis. He did not return from his furlough and ultimately committed assault, armed robbery, and rape before being captured and sentenced in Maryland. That was used prolifically,
yeah,
in that campaign. George Bush evidently was nice, but he could get down in the dirt. And Dennis emails, is it fair to say that George H.W. Bush was a good and decent president, but a nasty campaigner?
Well, I don't think he was necessarily a nasty campaigner.
And let me stop you there. But, yeah. Was it him or was it Lee Atwater?
Well, he says it was a political action committee. I guess he did say to Jesse Jackson that he thought he had regrets about that. But other reports have said he never apologized for that. And I think the furlough process is very complicated. But it was not Dukakis' fault for that. I think Willie Horton, what that did, when you look at the Daisy ad, and another one is the Willie Horton ad, it does play into racial stereotypes. And I think at that point, point in the country, there was a heightened awareness of violence. And I think that that worked for him, although it was
Well, we tend to put halos on our dead leaders. And I'm just wondering whether the halo is deserved here, or is it did he compromise his principles, or was he just a product of his time?
Well, I mean, I'll let Gibbs speak to this, but I think he was, that was maybe the first time in which you had a PAC deliver such type of ads. And now we have super PACs and PACs that do it all the time. And so maybe that is where you make the connection. Dirty ads were there before Trump, but Trump has been front and center with saying things that are racial and ethnic, and not just, they're more exponentially racial slurs.
But
he ran a lot of campaigns, and so, you know, to pick a few things out, I think is a little unfair.
Okay.
But he's, you know, he's part of this rightward, more hardline move by the Republicans in more sort of negative tone. But I put Newt Gingrich, somebody like Tom DeLay from Texas, you know, as more responsible for our current tone than George H.W. Bush.
And certainly all of whatever George Bush said in his lifetime as a candidate pales in comparison to our political rhetoric today, and way before the 1988 election in 1979, when his reputation for niceness had not yet been challenged. He appeared on Face the Nation on CBS as he campaigned for that year's or the next year's Republican presidential nomination, and he was asked about his toughness for the office.
One of the things that always comes up is that maybe George Bush is too nice a guy to be president. Maybe he's not tough enough.
Yeah, I've heard
if
that.
You can't take out after, what about the tough enough question? And
well,
start
tough
out,
enough
but if
is
you don't
I don't
want to
equate,
take out after
I don't
these
equate
other guys.
Toughness with just attacking some individual. I don't attack. I equate toughness with moral fiber, with character, with principle, with demonstrated leadership in tough jobs where you emerge, not bullying somebody, but with the respect of the people you led. That's toughness. That's fiber. That's character. I've got it. And if I happen to be decent in the process, that should not be a liability.
Boy, that's a 180 from today. do you think that he liked campaigning? Do you think he liked being a politician? He was certainly a leader. He certainly had ideas that he wanted to get across. But do you think he liked the process?
I'm not sure I can speak to that. But I think that John Meacham said that he was he wanted to assume leadership. It was kind of hardwired, in his words, into his DNA. So I think maybe leadership more than politics, although if you look at the past and the record, there were things that were clearly political offices. But I had never heard that quote that you played. And, I agree with the things about decision-making and character, although people can interpret character in many different ways. And I thought that was a very forceful statement by him. I was, moral fiber. And I guess I still, contrast it with today, in which toughness may be defined as bullying.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. We're seeing it through today's lens. He had no idea what was coming down the road in 30 years, 40 years, but it's interesting to hear it today. In 1988, after nearly 8 years as President Reagan's vice president, he campaigned in Rock Hill 2 days before South Carolina's first primary in the South. And he had just lost two contests, I think it was two, to Senator Bob Dole, who yesterday had a remarkable moment in front of the casket in the rotunda, where he actually stood from his wheelchair and saluted his former campaign rival. In South Carolina, though, George Bush sounded ready to fight.
You ought to be looking for who has had the experience and who has these values we believe in, and the experience and the stability to get the job done. Sometimes when you're a candidate, you can make flamboyant statements out here. I've done it myself. But when you have some responsibility for running something, you've got to project a certain sense of commitment to the American people, a certain stability based on experience to say, look, when the going gets tough, I'm the person to lead this country.
So, Gibbs, the South Carolina primary is the one that got the Bush campaign back on track. Why? What happened there that reversed his fortunes?
So he did a really good job of connecting himself to Reagan. You know, several of the candidates, Jack Kemp was running in South Carolina, tried to be the next Reagan, to be the continuation of Reagan. But, it's hard when Reagan's vice president was running. And Bush had, you know, two key things. He had Carol Campbell, who'd been elected governor, who was extremely popular, on his team. Carol Campbell wasn't on Bush's team in 80. He was on Reagan's team. And he also had, as we've talked about several times, Lee Atwater running his national campaign, a South Carolinian who, most would say was certainly a political mastermind, a dirty trickster, and somebody who went down and dirty with the best of them, but also, you know, was just ran very sophisticated campaigns for the time period. So, you know, connecting to Reagan, really good endorsements, you know, he was the front runner and came into South Carolina and did really, really well.
As president, he presided over the end of the Cold War. The Berlin Wall fell, and it could easily have led to chaos or worse because the Soviet Union was humiliated and they had nuclear weapons and they could have used them. He's credited with making sure that we didn't further the humiliation of the Russians at that point in time. He's credited with holding things together through his experience as an ambassador to the UN, as vice president, a man who had traveled the world and made personal connections with leaders, and as a former CIA director who knew things that we will never know about what were going on behind the scenes. Would it be safe to say that at that time and place, he was the best man in the world for that job?
Well, I think he had a remarkable resume. And I will say, too, people have said that he did not he took credit, or he understood, but he did not brag about the fall of the Berlin Wall and these things. He kind of just proceeded on. I think it was the best resume. I think you look at things that train people. You have to learn. The learning curve is steep for a presidency. Yeah. And I think he had some natural, not affinity, but he had a natural sense of what it took, both foreign and domestically. And I think that I can't speak for the world, but I think in his time, that was the most impressive resume. That's what I teach in my presidency class, about his resume. And I think it goes beyond just the resume on paper. He wouldn't have had these jobs had he not been successful.
He had a rough and tumble campaign against President, soon to be President, Bill Clinton. And it looked, there was every reason to believe there would be no reason for these two men to like each other. But the opposite has turned out to be true, Gibbs. And some have said that perhaps George H.W. Bush was the father that Bill Clinton never had.
Yeah, pretty amazing. They came together, on a number of initiatives to raise money and help out after devastating natural disasters, and so really impressive that they were able to set aside their differences in a real model. I mean, you know, again, part of our problem today in politics is our opponents are our enemies, and we once the election is over, we don't reach across the aisle. I mean, you know, as we think about George H.W. Bush today, you know, he left a real legacy that I hope we can go back to in politics, because our system doesn't work very well. Democracy doesn't work very well if the person on the other side is the enemy. And, you know, as we're seeing what's going on in, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan right now, you know, so your side doesn't win. You try to change the rules after an election. And so that's, you know, George H.W. Bush would not have been involved in anything like that.
I only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get back to something we referred to earlier today repeatedly. George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, took assignments at particularly difficult times. He became ambassador to the United Nations in 1971. At that time, the U.S. wanted both China and Taiwan to be in the organization. The U.N. took a vote. Taiwan was voted out. We lost. And the New York Times says delegates danced in the aisles, delighted to see the U.S. humiliated. And when Mr. Bush rose to speak, he was hissed at the U.N. He was the chairman of the Republican National Committee in the aftermath of the Watergate break-in. He was convinced that Nixon was innocent at the time. In 1976, he was chosen by President Ford to head the CIA, which was still reeling from accusations that it had abused its power under Nixon. He was credited with restoring morale in that organization at the time. But in preparation for his run for president in 88, he gave a series of speeches backing constitutional amendments, supporting a balanced budget, school prayer, restricting abortion. Some have said that he helped hand the Republican Party to the Christian right and began the redefinition of Republicanism from what it was when he entered politics to what it is today. Is that fair?
Well, I think I'd like to say that those things, and you have to look at a president not on the basis of what he or she accomplished, but also their agenda. I would resort back to what he said about himself, and that is the vision thing. I don't think he had the vision. I think those were things that were more transactional, and they were political, but I don't think it was part of any kind of conspiracy theory. And I think we ought to acknowledge before we go away that, you know, there were some things that were transformative. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, and there was a difference between foreign and domestic Bush.
Susan Roberts from Davidson College, you get the last word. Dr. Gibbs Knox, thank you from John Knotts. Thank you for joining us from the College of Charleston. President Bush's casket will leave the Capitol Rotunda in just a few minutes and arrive at 11 at Washington's National Cathedral for his state funeral. President Bush will attend but not speak. Instead, eulogies will be delivered by former President George W. Bush, former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, former Wyoming Republican Senator Alan Simpson, John Meacham, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian, and the author of the president's definitive biography will also speak. WFAE and NPR will bring you live coverage of that beginning at 11. Thank you both for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.